Thank you all. So this is the third and last meeting of this very brief survey. Oh, I see. This is the door to my room, to the room closed. Yes. So this is the last meeting in this very cursory, very brief survey we're doing of some of Rav Kook's ideas on Teshuvah. We've traced, we sort of talked about how Teshuvah, like so many things, is part of a conceptual vocabulary that thinkers and plain old Jews work with and revise over time. And we've seen how Rav Kook takes a cluster of Kabbalistic ideas associated with tshuva, which is tshuva associated with sort of the place and the divine structure of the world and the world of the Sefirot. Tshuva as the place to which one returns, as so to speak, a return to one's own spiritual womb, and a place of great freedom, right? A place of returning to most truly being oneself. And there's, you know, the in the womb, there's a kind of what freedom is, that you're not necessarily choosing a whole lot of stuff in the womb, but your life has been, so to speak, undetermined. Right, there's still great possibilities, and all the possibilities and potentialities that you have are there. And so one of Rav Kook's great conceptual innovations here is talking about freedom. The idea of identifying tshuva with the sfira binah and binah with chirut and yovel, right, sort of the freedom of the jubilee year, right, the time when all the slaves go free and land is restored to its rightful owners. So he didn't originate that, right? But it's the uses which he makes of it, and as you've probably observed by now, the sort of very dramatic, lyrical language with which he expresses these ideas. But it's lyrical and it's poetic, but there's also a lot of ideas, and it's one that resonates with distinctively modern notions of freedom, of selfhood, of subjectivity, of the truth being something that I discover within myself. And also, as we've started to see, one of Rav Kook's great innovations as a thinker is taking Kabbalistic ideas and categories and using them as ways of understanding and making sense of concrete social and political movements and things like nationalism and social justice movements and widespread rebellion against traditional rabbinic authority. And we're going to see some of that here as well. So, but first, when we talk about, and also, and one last bit of thing we're going, another thing we're going to see is, but doesn't tshuva have to do with like stopping, like to be sinful and to like repent of one's sins, right? You know, sort of in the midst of all this like wonderful Kabbalistic, mystical, romantic, poetic shavar marai, like, you know, whatever happened to like regretting one's sins and trying to be better and forgiveness and all of that. And we're going to see he talks about that too. But he has this interesting definition of what is sin, this different understanding of what is sin and what is forgiveness. So now, in our very first meeting, I forget which one of you raised this issue, but one of you very perceptively from the beginning, when as soon as I said, the Rav Kook talks about freedom, one of you said, asked, well, does he mean negative freedom or positive freedom? And I said, that's exactly the question, and then we'll be getting back to it. So we finally are. I hope you can see the screen. So the first quote is not from Rav Kook, not from the Kabbalah, not from anything, but it's from an encyclopedia article from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is available online. It discusses this idea of what is liberty, what is freedom. And this is just an excerpt from it, but there's an idea that has been about in among philosophers for several decades now, first introduced, as we'll see, by Isaiah Berlin. That when we talk about the word freedom, we tend to use it in several different senses. And a key distinction is what has come to be known as the distinction between positive liberty and negative liberty. Okay, so let's I'll just read from the encyclopedia entry here. Negative liberty is the absence of obstacles, barriers, or constraints. One has negative liberty to the extent that actions are available to one in this negative sense, right? There's things I want to do, and there's no external barrier standing in my way, right? There's nobody saying, don't do that, right? There's no institution or there's no object or there's no institution stopping me from doing what I want, right? I have a sense of what I want. I have an ability to do what I want, an innate ability to do what I want, and there's nothing sort of like getting in the way. But positive liberty is the possibility of acting or the fact of acting in such a way as to take control of one's life and realize one's fundamental purposes. Right? While negative liberty is usually attributed to individual agents, though it doesn't have to be, I would add, positive liberty is sometimes attributed to collectivities or to individuals considered primarily as members of given collectivities. This is a somewhat abstract way of putting the observation that when, especially nationalist movements, talk about achieving freedom, they're not just talking about removing restraints. They're talking about achieving some idea of themselves. But that's true for people, and that's true for people as individuals, and it's true for groups, right? Think for a moment about this term, self-determination, right? Self-determination is this term that we all use, and it's this sort of very common in international relations. Zionism, just take one example, is often referred to as the self-determination movement of the Jewish people, the Jewish people's right to self-determination. Conversely, other national groups, be they Palestinians or people in Northern Ireland or whomever, right, all talk about realizing self-determination. So when people talk about self-determination, they mean, of course, yes, they'll sort of getting to run their own affairs, not being told by others, not being stopped from doing what they want to do. But what is it that they want to do? And also, to determine oneself means to give oneself shape, to give oneself a sense, to decide for oneself what it is that you want to do, right? And that is more than somebody just not stopping you from doing something. That's more of you being able to achieve something, right? Let's continue in this encyclopedia entry. In the famous essay first published in 1958, Isaiah Berlin called these two concepts of liberty negative and positive, respectively. The reason for using these labels is that in the first case, liberty seems to be a mere absence of something, i.e. of obstacles, barriers, constraints, or interference from others. Whereas in the second case, it seems to require the presence of something, of control, self-mastery, self-determination, self-realization, right? Positive liberty is very much something that I feel within, right? In myself, I am free. In myself, because I am free, I truly can be myself, right? One example comes to mind for me. I remember some years ago seeing a documentary on PBS about the hymn "Amazing Grace," right? About the hymn "Amazing Grace." And at one point, Johnny Cash was interviewed, and Johnny Cash said, Johnny Cash knew a thing or two about being in prison, and he knew a thing or two about, falling apart in one's life and needing God's grace to restore yourself and so forth. And Johnny Cash said, when I sing Amazing Grace, I could be covered in chains, but I sing that song and I'm free as a bird. So I think that comment of his really puts into very stark relief what we're talking about. That negative freedom means nobody's putting chains on you, right? You can move around. But positive freedom means the way you can feel free and unconstrained and truly yourself and in touch with your best self as a human being, even when you're being constrained. One person in the chat asked if positive and negative liberty is a way of thinking in terms of Shabbat, like Shamor and Zachor. And that's actually a beautiful, analogy. You know, Shamor, like the mitzvot lota, say, don't do this, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And Zachor, sort of remembery, for those of you who've seen the Finding Dory movie, to remember the Shabbat, right? Affirmatively to do something, and yes, Susanna Levin points out Natan Sharansky is an example of this. That's a wonderful example, right? People who are in prison, so now Mona Fishbane says, I don't think you can have positive liberty or self-determination if you're in chains. Okay, you can't achieve self-determination, right? But the question is, can you feel free inside? Right, there's some sense in which perhaps you can free inside. You know, a key statement of positive liberty in the modern world is Jean-Jacques Rousseau in his book, The Social Contract, when the opening line is, you know, man is born free everywhere and is everywhere in chains, right? So the freedom is within and the chains are society. See, there's elements of this Rousseauian type thinking in Rav Kook, for better or worse. Now, to clarify, when, Mona's sharing this wonderful quote from Viktor Frankl, reflecting on his experiences in Auschwitz, there's a space between stimulus and response. We have some choice, but the chains limit our choice and options. True. I wouldn't presume to speak for Viktor Frankl, but remembering his book, when he talks about how in the concentration camp, in his mind, he would sort of be having these conversations with his wife, right? At that point, you know, that was his way of achieving some kind of freedom that obviously wasn't constrained, right? But here it's also freedom as a kind of, this also relates to things we talked about, I believe, Leo's Rav Kook and the return to nature, right? Freedom as being true to oneself. Right? Freedom as being true to oneself. Now, what does all of this have to do with tshuva? So let's get back to some of these texts here. Well, just in the interest of time, I'll be reading the English, but you have the Hebrew. The will, the ratzon, which derives from the power of tshuva, is the deep will of the depth of life. Not the superficial will, which grasps only the weak and external sides of life, but rather the will, which is the innermost nucleus of the foundation of life, and it is the very self-good of the soul. Rav Kook, like many Kabbalists, talks a great deal about the will. And in certain schools of thought in the Kabbalah, the will is essential, is that's where creation begins, right? When God, the Ein Sof, emanates outward into and sort of creates the dimensions of time and space, the first thing that emerges is the divine will, because there is a divine will to emanate out of infinity into finitude, to create finitude, right? We could go into more detail about this and how it plays out in all sorts of ways in Kabbalah. At first, it's a little arresting. It's a little strange what the will is like this. And so you realize the will here is being understood as this fundamental force of life. Kind of, you know, what the philosopher Henri Bergson calls the élan vital, as well as similarities to Henri Bergson, right? The élan vital, sort of this fundamental will to live. And in God's case, this fundamental will to give, right? For the Ramchal, who's very important for Rav Kook, Ramchal is one of the people from whom Rav Kook gets very much of his teachings about the will. And Ramchal is like, why does God want all this? Because God wants to do good. God wants there to be creatures with whom he can do good. Right? God wants to share a bit of his infinity with others. That sort of thing. And so tshuva, and again, this is also where Rav Kook does not sound like your stereotypical Musar Shmuzing Rosh Hashiva. A key step in doing tshuva is not about weakening your will when we say, you know, is, but it's strengthening your will. It's smelting your will. It's purifying your will so that your will actually functions, right? Because the ultimate for him and is that he wants to get away. Okay. He wants to get away from a sense of the will that's fundamentally neurotic, right? Think of your archetypal Woody Allen character, tearing himself to pieces with choosing, right? Or the archetypal Nebuchadnezzar, sort of these characters out of Philip Roth, right? These sort of very archetypal American Jews who are just like tearing themselves to pieces over having to choose. And sort of Cook, and you sense that there's echoes of Nietzsche here, you're not wrong. That's fundamentally sick, right? There's something fundamentally ill about someone who's constantly doubting themselves, constantly undercutting themselves, constantly doubting their own ability to do good in the world, constantly not having faith in themselves in a very deep way. Now, he's not against introspection, of course, but the goal of this is to liberate the good that is within you. Again, because ideally, as I've said, for a cook, the goal is for a person to do the good as naturally as you eat or breathe, right? Without, you know, not to break yourself to do something good, but rather to train yourself to want the good in a very fundamental way, the same way you want to be healthy, right? And that's why if you take a look at, you know, you notice that this text comes from Orod HaTshuva. Orod HaTshuva is an actual treatise that Rav Kook wrote on Tshuva. Most of Orod HaTshuva is like, it's the first three chapters work sort of like a treatise, but most of Orod HaTshuva is different notebook selections of his, like the ones we're looking at, and you'll see a number of them that we're going to look at today, also appear in Orod HaTshuva that were put there, edited, you know, by his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda. But in the early chapters, where Rav Kook sort of tries to lay out a more systematic way of looking at Tshuva, one of the first things he talks about is Tshuva Tivit. Tshuva Tivit, natural Tshuva. What's natural Tshuva? Because like working with your own wanting something good, your own wanting to do good, the goodness that's inside of you, and the ways in which when you're doing the good, you feel good, right? Even at a very basic level. Now, moving forward, the kinds of inner freedom that Rav Kook sought. This is just another remarkable passage from one of his diaries. Expanses, expanses, my soul craves divine expanses. Don't fence me into any cage, corporeal or spiritual. My soul flies in heavenly expanses. The heart's walls can't contain it. Neither the walls of action, morals, logic, or manners. Above it all, she soars and flies above all that can be called by any name beyond all pleasure, all grace, and beauty. Above every exalted and noble, atzili, noble or emanated thing, I am sick with love, cholat avan. Now, what's interesting here, I mean, this is like often in his journals, this is a record of a remarkable religious experience, of a desire for a kind of expansiveness, for drinking deep of the well of the world, of being at one with the world in a way that dissolves all sorts of familiar boundaries. Now, what's interesting here is that also, and this is throughout, there's a whole cluster of passages like this in this particular notebook, in Shmonach Kvatzim, notebook, Kovetz Gimel, is that it's very clear that Rav Kook is reflecting on his own religious experiences, but he also is always has the Kabbalah in mind. In the Kabbalah, the first person singular, Ani, is a synonym for the Shekhinah. In the Kabbalah, as we've said, like the Shekhinah, has many synonyms in the Kabbalah. The Shekhinah, the divine presence in the world, is synonymous with the Torah Sheba'al Peh, with Eretz Yisrael, with Knesset Yisrael, the sacred community of Israel, and also with the first person singular pronoun, Ani, I, right? And so there's something about the lone individual, which is reflective of God's aloneness in the world, right? and God makes oneself present as the individual makes themselves present. And in the same way, sort of like this idea that divinity can't be contained by this world, right? When Rav Kook talks about morals here, Musar, because I've thought about this passage for a long time, he doesn't say like, I want to be unethical and I want to go out and like start slaughtering people, etc. But this is one of the times when he uses Musar. Often he discusses Musar at great length. My teacher Rav Amital pointed out that Musar is the one word that appears more in his corpus than anywhere else. This is another very famous passage in Shmona Kvatzim, also appears in the Rosh HaKodesh, where Rav Kook lists something like 20 different meanings of the word Musar for him. But here, I think what he means is, again, like morals, ethics in its narrow sense, or what I called earlier, its neurotic sense, right? Sort of like this, you know, that like when you're acting not out of a sense of like wanting to do the good, but should I do this, should I do that? Okay, that seems the better thing to do. He wants to somehow get away from that, get beyond that. And why? Because I am sick with love, and he's obviously sick with love for God, right? Also, the I is sick with love. The Shekhinah is, so to speak, sick with love, because the Shekhinah is God, as his loving, most accessible presence. So, and these are also the ways, not to sound sort of too narrowly sociological or ideological, but it's moments like this, I think you'll know what I mean when I say like it's very hard to read Rav Kook to slot him as a conventional. So is he Orthodox or not Orthodox? Like this is, you see, like he's fracturing these, not that these categories necessarily work, but these sorts of obvious categories don't seem to work here for him, right? You know, because also like, is this how an Orthodox, quote unquote Orthodox rabbi talks, right? He's not interested in that. He's interested in this extremely living, vital sense of Torah. Okay. Now, so what is sin in all of this? There's no such thing as sin. No, there is sin. Right. Sin is what gets in the way. Right? Rav Kook has this fundamentally idealistic, optimistic view of the human condition, and sin and the mitzvot are there, as far as he's concerned, to liberate us, right? They are to move you towards your best self, right? They are meant to unleash your will. They're meant to unleash your goodness. They're meant, as we've said, Rav Kook sees Tamei HaMitzvot sort of prospectively, right? Unlike the Rambam, who views Tamei HaMitzvot, the enterprise for finding rationales for the commandments, for seemingly, you know, for commandments that are hard to understand. Whereas Maimonides tends to look backward, right, and say, well, during the time when people were, you know, worshiping idols, so that's why this or that practice, you know, like offering animal sacrifices like this or keeping chatnez or that made sense. Rav Kook shares the view of the Rambam and Saadia and the Meiri and others that there are no commandments in the Torah that are purely irrational, right? That God, you know, like as Chazal put it, in HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'bitron ya'im b'riyotav, God does not act tyrannically with his creatures, right? God doesn't just like give you a mitzvot to say limbo. Okay, now everybody limbo. I jump, now everybody's supposed to say how high. There's always reasons for the mitzvot, right? But he sees reasons prospectively. The mitzvot are trying to educate us towards a higher ethic in the future, when indeed, he sometimes writes, the ethics that when by the standards of that, you know, contemporary halachic ethics may indeed seem deficient. Right? Vegetarianism is the most obvious example. So what is sin? Sin is what gets in the way. Sin is what gets in the way of your fundamentally wanting to do good. Every sin grieves the heart. Why? Because it contradicts the unity of the individual personality with all of being. Right? Sin is what keeps us from connecting with the world and connecting with other people and connecting most deeply with ourselves and thus with God. That's why sin hurts. That's why sin is painful in and of itself, right? And it heals only through tshuva, which shines onto it, onto the heart. And it's in this, before this whole passage is taken from the school that I'm talking about, it shines onto the heart a light of the heavenly flow of idealism or idealness, which constitutes reality. And with that, there returns the broad equanimity and proper fit to the being which is manifest in it. And he quotes the verse in Yeshayahu, "V'shav Rafalo," and he returns and healing comes to him. So remember, as I said, like Reb Cook is very idealist. He's both, he's an idealist at heart. Again, he has this very idealistic view of human condition. He's also an idealist in the philosophical sense that the world is fundamentally about ideas working themselves out through history. And again, as I've said, a very deft philosophical move is that he takes this word ideas, this concept of ideas and ideals. Ideals both understood as human aspirations, human moral, cultural, social aspirations to make the world better. Ideals as the idea of sort of like the large concepts and categories and structure that through which our minds come to understand the world and through which we function. And he identifies that with the spirit, such that human idealism in terms of wanting to make the world a better place, human idealism in terms of trying to understand the world is God's presence in the world. It's how God is working through the world. And so coming to understand oneself, like, and really living one's ideals and really inhabiting one's ideas is a deep form of tshuva. Also, you've noticed just this stylistic gesture, it's very characteristic of Rebbe's writings, the Shav Rafalo, at the end of these very expansive theological, mystical, etc. musings, he often cites a single pasuk or a line from the Siddur. On the one hand, it's a very, it's a sort of lyrical, poetic touch, but there's also a theological doctrine behind it. Because remember, as we said, Rav Kook is a disciple of the Vilna Gaon. And a key teaching of the Vilna Gaons is that all of the Torah, all of Revelation, all the Torah, all the Kabbalah, is rooted in its divine source, which means that in halakhic terms, the machlokot, the differences of opinions among the medieval commentators, the Rishonim, are ultimately traceable to passages in the Talmud, right? And disagreements in the Talmud are ultimately traceable to the Mishnah, and disagreements in the Mishnah are ultimately traceable to the Bible itself, right? To ambiguities in the biblical text or different biblical texts going in different directions. The idea here is it's put lachzir. This isn't just like a clever bit of reconstruction. The theological idea is l'hachzir kol davar l'shorsho, right? Everything must be returned to its source in divinity. So ideas also, so like, because God's revelation, right? So also because the sense, like the tshuva in a deep way, and this is also Rav Kook talking, right? The tshuva is this force pulsing through the universe. Torah is a force pulsing through the universe. And just the same way the blood circulates, it returns, right? So part of the study of Torah is to relaxir kol davar l'shorasho, and when you do that in your Torah study, when you manage to, like, really, that's part of why the Vilna Gaon places such emphasis on Torah studies, the supreme religious act, that is how you connect with the divine mind. And you connect, you sort of return to the revelation at Sinai by taking the most developed ideas in halakha, or in this case, mystical theology, and rooting them in the biblical text, is a way of you getting back to that revelatory moment yourself, right? If, you know, sometimes it occurs to me, you know, the way the Vilna Gaon looks at things, if, the risk of sounding a little flip, if Virginia Woolf had this famous essay, A Room of One's Own, Rav Kook sees Torah study as creating a Sinai of one's own, right? Every time you learn Torah, and especially if you do it with an awareness, which is where Vilna Gaon's method is concerned, of tracing everything back to scripture, you are once again at Sinai. I see there's some questions in the chat, and I wouldn't want to. Yes, this is at the center. Someone pointed out, Irene Lancaster pointed out that this is at the center of Ibn Gabirol's Keter Malchut. Irene, would you mind just saying explicitly what you find at the center of? I'm glad you mentioned that. Well, just say Ibn Gabirol's magnificent poem Keter Malchut is indeed a crucial source. It's one of the crucial sources for the introduction of Neoplatonic ideas into it's a major, like, a celebration. What?
I've done a lot of work on Jewish philosophy. I love your stuff, and I'm teaching your book.
That's kind of you to say, but it's neither here nor there. Yeah.
Right, the point is that I translated Keter Malchut, which I think is used by the Sephardi community. Yes, in a book for Routledge on Jews under Islam, because they've been
gathering. Oh, lovely.
Yeah, so I have just actually been teaching clergy about Psalms. And I mentioned how we, the Jews, tend to think of going from God, you know, person to God and God to person. And I quoted this, you know, my translation of will and wisdom. And these were very concepts. I think he was extremely pioneering, Ibn Gabirol. It's not to detract from Rav Kook, of course.
Rav Kook's intellectual lineage, of course,
I hope you don't think I was rude. The person asked progressive about women because I'm the British on that. Right. I'm not allowing them.
Thank you. Because also part of what Ibn Virol's poem Keter Malchut is also very much about this idea of the universe as this. Right.
Absolutely.
Versus a side of longing of a human desire to return to God and be one with God. And that's very what is working on here. So now at this point, I'd like to keep moving through the text as he's working through this idea of what is sin. And here he states very explicitly. Sin.
Yehuda.
Yes.
Again, okay. I got a couple people comment. That's usually fine, but once in a while your voice fades in and out, meaning sometimes you get too far from the mic. So just talk nice and loud.
Nice and loud. I know my daughters, when I teach, they say, Abba's screaming at the computer.
Go ahead.
Sin, for Rav Kook, right? Sin is like, imagine there's a light. Imagine there's a streaming light. And something then blocks it up, right? Sin is an opacity that blocks the light. Sin blocks, and here we are, sin blocks the illumination of the higher wisdom. Now again, chokhmah in Kabbalah doesn't just mean being wise. Chokhmah is keter chokhmah binah. It's one of the very highest sfirot, right? And in the Kabbalah, and certainly in the Kabbalah of the Vilna Gaon, right, chokhmah is the fount of revelation. Sin blocks the illumination of the higher wisdom, whose revelatory path proceeds through the simple harmony of the soul, which understands the wholeness of all being and its heavenly source. Every practical sin, every concrete sin, rips this ideal unity, places the circle of life outside of it, and the manifestation, which trickles out like a clear fountain, no longer flows to that hallowed will, it should be hallowed will, until he returns and regrets. And the light of tshuva, in proportion to the clarity of understanding and the depth of information, will restore that harmony to its former strength. Oh, return to me the joy of your deliverance, and a generous spirit sustain me. Right? Hashiva li sason yishecha v'ruach nidivecha n'ru v'ruach nidivat samkeini. So in practical terms, think about the moment when you're think about a moment when you were doing a mitzvah and it was all coming together. So when I think about this, the association that comes to me is like a time, say, saying Kiddush on Friday night. Lighting Shabbat candles on Friday night. And this moment when you're feeling peace and calm and you're doing it just right, and it's like the choreography of the mitzvah is coming together, and it's just beautiful. And then imagine you mess that up. Imagine you mess it up. Imagine I'm standing there at the Shabbos table, I'm saying Kiddush for my family, and, all of a sudden I, reach out and turn the light on. I shatter the moment. It hurts. It feels bad. You are achieving something. There was something coming together. There was something harmonious, right? Imagine sometime when you were doing a mitzvah, and then you're doing a mitzvah with someone, and then you find out, imagine you're doing a mitzvah with somebody and you know, like imagine I'm going to like make a minion for someone, and there's me and somebody else, and like we're struggling. It's like hard for us to get to minion, but the other guy is really doing it, and I'm only doing it, you know, to spite somebody else, right, or whatever. Think about these times when, like, through mitzvot, and also just in our lives, like, something is going well. Things are going nicely. You're behaving well. You're behaving like you've got a good thing going. You've caught the wave. And sin stops it, smashes it. It gets in the way. The regret that you feel, because regret is something that one is supposed to feel. It's a necessary step in tshuva. Rav Kook hears this so often. Remember, we said over and over again, for Rav Kook, he's like urging you to take your inner life seriously. Your regret about something, the pain that you feel about your spiritual alienation is a thing. It's something in the world, right? The regret that you feel is real. It's connected to, so to speak, like a divine energy in the world, which also like feels bad when it's stifled. And again, he's reconceptualizing what mitzvot are by reconceptualizing what sin is, right? As far as he's concerned, there's goodness all around. There's divine light all around. Mitzvot are there to sort of walk you through. One way of looking at mitzvot, they're a way to like walk you through and guide you to unleashing the good that's in yourself and in the world. And sin blocks them. And here, one of the most remarkable passages in his writing. I'll read it first in Hebrew and then in English. Adam hakoev tamid al avonotav avonot haolam. Tzarichu tamid limchol lisloach la'atzmo ulolam kulo. Uvzeh hu mamshich slicha ve'or chesed al havaya kula. Umsameach lamakom, umsameach lamakom. ובתחילה צריך למחול לעצמו, ואחר כך הוא ממשיך מחילה כללית על הכל, וכל הקרוב קרוב קודם, על ענפי שורשיו מצד הנשמה, ועל משפחתו, אוהביו, דורו, אומתו, עולמו, וכל העולמים. הוא מתגלה כל הטוב הגנוז בכל, ובא לברכת אברהם, שאין דור שאין בו כמותו. One who grieves constantly for his sins and the sins of the world must constantly forgive and absolve himself from the whole world. And in so doing, he draws forgiveness and a light of loving kindness unto all of being and brings joy to God and his creatures. And he must first forgive himself and afterwards cast a broad forgiveness over all, the nearest to him first, on the branches of the roots of the soul, and on his family, his loved ones, his generation, and his world and all worlds. And thus is, it says thus, but should be thus is revealed all the good that is hidden away in everything. And he attains the blessing of Abraham. There is not, of whom there is not one generation in which his likeness does not emerge. So he's, again, describing a remarkable experience here. And it's not like a kind of easy forgiving oneself, because who's he saying this to? Notice who this is addressed to. One who grieves constantly for his sins and the sins of the world, right? Sort of if you are constantly, you know, start like, how do we deal with a deep awareness of sin? And sometimes it seems insuperable. So somehow you have to forgive. And somehow you have to forgive yourself. And you have to forgive the world. And what's striking, the process that he describes here, it's a kind of like concentric circles of forgiveness. It's almost like, you know, the image, it's like a pebble dropped into a pond and it's rippling out. Or sort of these, the way I often think of it is like these great exhalations. By the way, breathing, of course, is, you know, it's no accident, right, that when God is described as merciful, God is described as, you know, Erech HaPayim. It doesn't mean like God has a long face, right? It means that God takes deep breaths, right? Sort of, you know, God takes a deep breath. God takes a deep breath and forgives, right? And so this is, he's talking about forgiving oneself. And also what's so remarkable in this passage is that, you know, it starts with the individual, Adam, who's like grieving for his own sins and the sins of the world around him. But almost the only way to forgive is to recognize that you're connected to the world around you, right? You forgive yourself. And somehow you have to find a way to forgive others, right? Forgiving one's family members, sometimes that's not easy. One's friends, one's generation, one's nation. It's really not easy, I think, frankly, those of us who live in, you know, like we're living through times of like great political conflict. It's not easy to forgive, and you can't always do it. I mean, this is me talking, right? But the sense of forgiveness is a kind of like reconciliation. And there's the sense that if you forgive here, you are sort of like opening the channels, opening the sluices of forgiveness into the world, and you're enabling, and sort of you're forgiving the world is somehow God working through you into the world to come at peace. Now, what's striking here is also, this reminds me of like, say, when Rav Kook talks about a great deal about Ahavat Yisrael, loving other Jews. And as he says, Ahavat Yisrael, mitzvah gadol b'Torah. Ahavat Yisrael is a large subject in Torah. Like when there, the analogy there is like when Rav Kook says like, Ahavat Yisrael, okay, you want to love all Jews, you actually have to think about how to do it. Right? And he develops this vast philosophical conceptions to figure out what it means to love other Jews, especially when they're behaving so differently from you and behaving in ways that you can't stand, right? And here too, he's not saying, oh, I forgive my, you know, okay, I did something really bad. Okay, I forgive myself. I need to forgive myself. Fine. That's, you know, he's not talking about the kind of thing that one sees in, you know, unconfessional talk shows. So I mean, like a process, because like if forgiveness is about making God present in the world, easily letting yourself off the hook won't do that. Right? And it means, and you can only forgive by taking some larger picture and trying to see how do things fit together? How do people relate to one another? How have my sins affected other people's lives? Or how was I affected by other people's sins? I mean, this is a passage you can spend all Yom Kippur. The last text we'll be looking at. And this is sort of like almost like a summing up of so much of his thinking here. Kishishochim et hanshama hatzmit, kishimisichim de'a milastekel b'tochiyot. Well, I'll read the English for the sake of time. We can ask questions next session. When we forget our own, I use the word subjective because hatzmit means like our soul itself. But he also very much means atzmiyut. It's a word he uses a great deal. And he means it as subjectivity in the modern sense, right? That there's a locus of truth inside of me. And there's a kind of truth that only I can know. When we forget our own subjective soul, when we distract ourselves from looking at our inner lives, and here distracting ourselves from looking at our inner lives is like a pretty good description of how most of us live our lives these days between Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and endless emails and you name it. When we distract ourselves from looking at our inner lives, everything becomes confused and uncertain. We're not listening anymore. And the main teshuvah that lights up the darkness in an instant is that one return to oneself, to the roots of one's soul, and immediately return to God, to the soul of all souls, and stride forward up and up in holiness and purity, right? The soul is sort of like the deepest part of oneself, right? And there's this idea that God, one finds it in the Kabbalah and Chassidut, that God is the soul of all souls, right? The idea of the soul is that there's something to us that is deeper, that is richer, that is more true. And that itself comes from God. And is that sort of God is somehow the soul of the soul of the soul. It's like trying to find the deepest truths of ourselves and our place in the human condition and the world. And this is the case with a lone individual, a whole people, all of humanity, with the restoration of all being, whose ruin always proceeds from forgetting itself. And if it desires to return to God, but isn't prepared to gather its scattered ones, right? To the scattered portions of one's soul, the scattered, also like mekabetz nidahav, right? That you want to, the soul wants to return, but you can't return to God by lopping off who you are, right? And you can't bring your people, you can't bring humanity back to God by sort of discarding large parts of humanity, right? This is a deceptive tshuva, taking God's name in vain, right? And so only by the great truth of tshuva to oneself will a person and the nation, the world and all the worlds, all of being returned to its maker, to light and the light of life. And that is the secret of the light of the Messiah. The coming into view of the soul of the world, with whose illumination the world will return to the root of being. And God's light will reveal itself upon it. And from the source of this great tshuva, man will draw the sacred life force of true tshuva. So this is rather heady stuff. So tshuva, and again, Rav Kook is not saying all of this by way of discarding halakha, because of course, just read his multiple treatises on halakha, and his care for halachic practice. But he's talking about putting this in a larger frame. Mona Fishbane points out in the chat that extending forgiveness and loving kindness to oneself, one's family, loved ones, and broader and broader concentric circles is similar to the Buddhist loving kindness metta practice. And I think the answer to that observation is, you know, to my mind, obviously correct. I mean, we could talk about, you know, Rav Kook was somewhat familiar with Buddhism and he had ideas about it. He didn't care for Buddhist renunciation of the world, though he thought it was honest. But this notion, and there's, I mean, it's a subject for a longer conversation, sort of like the currents through which different mystical ideas circulate. But yes, you know, he's talking about forgiveness. I mean, this kind of forgiveness that Rav Kook talks about, forgiving oneself and forgiving one's family and one's nation, forgiving one's historical epoch, forgiving the world, and forgiving all the worlds, which is to say, like, all the multiple dimensions of existence. It's not something you can do in, like, you know, an afternoon, I don't think. He's talking about, like, this is a process that one undertakes. And this idea of returning to oneself, obviously, again, he's a very idealistic individual. He's staking all of this. He's staking all this on a belief that we do have a best self, and that there's good inside us and we can become better. That we, by becoming, so to speak, better than we are becoming truly who we are or who we were meant to be. Now, of course, one can't not note that that this also seems to have political resonances, right? I mentioned the connections to Rousseau, and they can run quite deeply. I mean, Rav Kook is also writing all this in the context of the Jewish return to Zion. That the Jewish people's return to the land of Israel is itself part of this process of tshuva. And not simply that they're doing tshuva because, like, they're doing mitzvot atliyot ba'aretz and they'll start doing tshumot and masrot and hopefully they'll do shemitah and all this kind of stuff. Well, yes, that's obviously true. But he's talking more about this larger historical process. And indeed, like, especially when it comes to shemitah, his halachic writings are very much in dialogue with this idea of the historical processes that are underway in which he's taking part. To swing back to our earlier conversation earlier today, a sort of monologue, I hope you think it was something of a conversation, these distinctions between negative and positive liberty. Negative liberty is, so to speak, the liberty of the liberal state, right? It's the job of the state to get out of the way. the state is not there to, it's enable you, like, you know, like it says in the American Declaration, life, liberty, the absence of restraint, and the pursuit of happiness. The state is there to enable you to pursue your bliss if you like, but it's not meant to be your bliss, or it's not meant to provide. That's why Rav Kook, elsewhere in his writings, and this is one of the more disturbing things in his writings, he very much denigrates the liberal state. He denigrates the liberal state as, you know, he borrows a line from Ralph Waldo Emerson, that the liberal state is nothing but like a glorified insurance company. But it's not something that will summon people to their greater or better selves. I mean, personally, this is where I part company with Rav Kook. I think it's okay for the state to leave good enough alone. And you know, frankly, I think it's very dangerous for the state to take upon itself the task of bringing people to their truest self-fulfillment, and that the state being, you know, the locus of realization of one's own deepest self-fulfillment. And that's something we could talk about at length. But I think that's so much of the challenge with Rav Kook, especially because here in Israel, of course, his writings are very political, or they're taken in very political ways. And these very Rousseauian ideas of the will fuel, you know, political movements, actors here in Israel, to talk about, you know, like, well, we understand the will of the people better than others, and we'll take it upon ourselves to educate the people on what their will ought to be. So as you can tell, you know, like this for a long time, there's a lot of me personally speaking that, like, I'm deeply in love with Rav Kook and his teachings. And at the same time, it's like, as it is with any thinker, to sort of take a look and see, like, what are these remarkable ways in which he revitalizes our religious conception, our religious vocabulary, our religious concepts, and thus reshapes our sense of who we are and what we are doing as human beings. And yet, how does that relate to all the various sectors of life? And how do we understand this in light of other and different conflicting teachings and approaches to tshuva? I mean, one of the beauties of Rav Kook's approach is that he was very much about celebrating other points of view, including other approaches to this question of tshuva, even as we've tried to present their own. So we have time for a few questions. I see in the chat Annie Gourmets asks, I talked about sparks of light. Is that in a way like Heschel's ideas? Well, yes. I mean, obviously, you know, Rav Kook and Rabbi Heschel make for a really interesting comparison because there's great similarities between them. There's also some genuine differences. And in some ways, like, and the comparison is kind of illuminating. I mean, if you take a look at, I mean, in some ways, you know, it's something I regularly tell people, if you want to get a quick handle on differences in, like, fundamental approaches to Jewish theology between America and Israel, a great way to begin is just to sort of start with the observation that for American religious thinkers, the key religious thing, you know, for traditional-minded religious thinkers, the key thinkers are Joseph, Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Heschel, and in Israel, it's Rav Kook, who is a I mean, we can leave Rav Soloveitchik for another time, but the comparisons with Rabbi Heschel, the ecstatic language, the ways in which I think you would agree by now that in reading Rav Kook, I wonder if you would agree with me that in reading Rav Kook, the literary force and power of how he's expressing himself is no less a piece of the package than the actual ideas that he's putting forth. And at the same time, so we're getting to the specific question of sparks, he's less interested. Rabbi Heschel is much more of a Hasidic thinker, and so talks a lot more about sparks. Rav Kook is aware of Hasidic thought and draws on Hasidic thought, but he doesn't talk about raising sparks as much as letting light flow. I know that is cutting the distinctions a little thin, but it's I think a meaningful difference. And finally, Mona Pishvain asks, does Rav Kook think we return to a good self that's already formed? We return to a kernel of goodness that needs to be developed or refined? That's a wonderful question. And characteristically, Graham, I think the answer would somehow be both. That the goodness is somehow already there in potentio, but it needs to be like worked through, and it needs to be developed, and it becomes developed in part through like the clashes of opposites, through throwing oneself against this world. Again, it's this sense that, I mean, just to use like straightforward Kabbalistic imagery, right? You know, there's the river that flows from Eden, and it has the multiple tributaries, right? And then sooner or later, it all returns and flows into the sea and then flows back to Eden. So on the one hand, in the one hand, it's all there, like sort of the first, in some sense, the first bit of flow out of Eden. It's all right there, and it's returning to the source. And at the same time, as the tributaries are sort of breaking ground and expanding outward, they are doing new things, and they are fertilizing new ground and making possible new kinds of growth that in some sense was already present in potentia at the beginning, but needed to come to fruition in order for it actually to return. And because Rav Kook is a Judaic thinker, because this also gets to a lot of his polemic of Christianity, he very much affirms the body, right? Kodesh has to proceed from Chol. That's part of why halacha is very important to him. There's a lot of reasons why, but it's one of like, things have to be embodied, right? You know, you can't transcend body and soul. You can't, you know, like the body cannot be spiritualized if it doesn't proceed through itself. Right? Mona, I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that helps clarify. Maybe I hope it helps clarify a little. Rabbi Kelman, are we doing okay? Are we out of time?
I think we're doing okay. It's 12:01, so I think we can wrap up unless there's somebody has a question they'd like to pop in, a quick question, we'll be happy to.
Right, and I'm sorry for going dark. I should have turned on the light.
That's here. Okay. It's like watching a movie, you know, you're supposed to watch in the dark.
Whether it's
the dark and the likeness. We have Rav Kook. We've got to let in the likeness to the dark. We have to start with the whether dark after Yom Kippur, who can be light.
Or our show or what have you. Right.
Okay. I want to really thank you for...
Well, thank you.